Alexa, what's the best radio station in LA?
There's nothing better than KCRW.
Take Alexa's word for it, not ours. Smart speakers and other voice assistants are becoming a staple in a lot of our homes. But researchers say there are some privacy risks that come with this new technology. We're going to talk about that later on in the show. First, though, we continue our series of interviews with the top contenders in the race to be California's next governor. Today, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. He's a Democrat, and he has a solid lead in the polls. It'll be a big surprise if he doesn't win one of the spots in the June 5th primary. The top two vote getters will advance to the November general election. I spoke with Gavin Newsom earlier. Okay, so make your point. Why should you be the next governor of California? Will it be four more years of Jerry Brown, essentially?
No, I want to build on Jerry Brown's legacy. I think he did a remarkable job at solvency, triaging the state, and we're debating no longer deficits. Now we're debating the sizes of surpluses. I think he's done a remarkable job. But for me, the issue that is the stubborn issue, that's an issue that's bigger than even the state of California, is the issue of the haves and have-nots. In California, we, as we all know, are the richest, now the fifth largest economy in the world, and the poorest state in this country. 8 million people living below the poverty line. And depending on you look at supplemental poverty index, by some estimates, 46% of our kids are at or near poverty levels. That's a disgrace. That issue has to be addressed. That's the issue to me that defines all other issues.
And what is the number one issue within those issues that's contributing to that?
I think it's a 50-year trend line. And it occurred to me a number of years ago that our interventions simply come too late. It's not people being left behind. It's not an achievement gap. It's a readiness gap. People start behind. 85% of the brain is fully formed by the time you're just 3 years old. If we don't have a prenatal care policy, if we're not focusing on those first three critical years, then we're not getting serious about addressing the issue of poverty. And so for me, our interventions come too late, and I want to change that trajectory.
And you say that will go a long way to erasing the gap between the rich and the poor?
I think the only way we're going to address the issue of poverty is systemically addressing the root causes of it. The number one predictor of whether or not you're going to end up in the criminal justice system, number one, is how many words you speak in kindergarten. It's the 45 million words that are heard in a high-income family by the time you get into kindergarten versus the 13 million words in a low-income household. That's the 32 million word gap that seemed to get a lot of attention a decade ago but hasn't been a point of focus in terms of our public policy. If that's the number one predictor of whether or not you're going to end up in the criminal justice system, maybe we should begin to do something about it.
Okay. How does that then connect to the fact that most people who live in our cities can't really afford to live in a house in our cities, that they are spending upwards of a half to three quarters of their income just to rent an apartment?
Well, the issue of affordability is the bubble word. It's the word I hear more often than any other word. Affordability defined, you're right, by cost of housing, number one, cost of childcare, number two, cost of education, number three. But the issue of affordability as it relates to housing is pretty obvious. We're 49th out of 50th in the United States in per capita housing units. Only Utah develops less housing than the state of California. By some estimates, we need to develop 3.5 million housing units by 2025, which means not doubling, not tripling, but quadrupling the annual production of housing.
So that's 500,000 a year.
It's 500,000 when the next governor gets sworn in the next year.
And that's just to tread water.
And that's
really.
The argument there is we haven't done that since 1954. So it's been done, but it just hasn't been done in half a century.
So how would you do it?
The fact is we have no choice. The audacity of the goal is the audacity of the problem. You can have a solution that doesn't solve the problem that people think is realistic, but then you've just argued to fail more efficiently. I think you have to be audacious, you have to be bold, and so we laid out 15 specific strategies to achieve that and could bore you with the issues around land use fiscalization and addressing some of the categorical exemptions for socially desirable projects under CEQA, et cetera, and addressing the time value of money. But I can more substantively make this point. Here's the value proposition. Cities are not incentivized to develop housing. And cities, at the end of the day, are the ones that will ultimately determine the fate of our housing production disproportionately. Mayors need to be incentivized for good behavior, not bad behavior. I would argue the most important thing we can do is shift the funding, shift the incentives. We're all creatures of incentives. Redirect dollars in a very different way than we do to cities versus counties as it relates to housing production. And number two, that's the carrot. On the other side, you got to look at this issue as a transportation issue as much as it is a housing issue. And we've got to link transit dollars to housing production.
But you were against a state Senate bill that would have done just that, would have mandated more housing construction near transit centers. The bill died, but you had said that had it passed, you would not have signed it.
And I also was criticized for celebrating its intent and the champion behind it, Scott Wiener, who's a big supporter of mine. And Scott was the first to acknowledge it was a moving target. So Scott's going back to the drawing table, recognizing what we already knew and what he already knew. We have 470 plus cities, 58 counties. Each is unique. Each is distinctive. And the difficult problem of selling down a vision top down is creating the energy bottom up. So the spirit of it is spot on. It was audacious and bold, but he recognized, and I think all of us recognize, that the details matter. And that's mm-hmm. why I think that fell short.
But I think you're always going to come up against local opposition to these kinds of projects for various reasons, for a myriad of reasons, as you've just laid out. And the bottom line being that the people who control the localities kind of like it the way it is, and they don't want a lot more development because it means more traffic. It means more, maybe more potential problems. How would you, as the governor of the state, override those local concerns and say, all right, we've given you enough carrots. You don't seem to be biting on the carrots. We're going to force you to do this in the interest of the entire state.
Well, we haven't provided the carrots, and that's what I'm arguing for, nor have we exercised the stick, as I'm also arguing for. So I think that's a way of answering your question substantively as it relates to the disincentive for bad behavior and the incentive for bad behavior, which is there's no cost of not doing your job at the local level. And localism, you're right, is determinative. And as a former county supervisor, as a two-term mayor, in a very, very challenging, dense urban environment, San Francisco, where NIMBYism reigns supreme and affordability is the issue that defines all other issues, I have a little bit of experience with it. And so
But looking at San Francisco, though, it's, as you say, it's a mess right now when it comes to affordability and the homeless everywhere. So, I mean, can you argue that what you did in essence failed? Because if you look at San Francisco now,
we built more housing than any other time in our 5-year history, at least previous to 10-year history previous to my tenure. And of course, the next mayor did the same. It's a fire hose. San Francisco's challenge is success. Everybody wants to move in. It's a macroeconomic challenge. The only way San Francisco's the city is going to address affordability is to broaden and regionalize approaches to addressing the issues. So yeah, we have an affordability crisis broadly defined in cities, specifically more broadly defined in rural areas as well, because we simply aren't building enough housing. We're not preserving enough existing housing stock, and we're not addressing the issue of prevention, which is addressing the issue of owner move-in evictions, Ellis Act evictions, making sure we preserve and protect the opportunities for tenants to get counseling services and legal aid, as well as subsidies to keep them in place so they're not displaced in the first place.
But has it been a failure of leadership? Has it been a failure of vision on the part of Democrats who have, by and large, controlled the state?
It's been, I think all of us have a responsibility. Society becomes how we collectively behave, all of us. And you made the point that NIMBYism reigns supreme. I got mine. That's not a Democratic lens or Republican lens. That's people that enjoy their quality of life. We've got to create a mindset that includes in the vernacular, the commonwealth, community, something bigger than ourselves. And yeah, it's been a lack of leadership, but leadership can be found anywhere. It's not just the folks up there on the white horse that are going to come save the day in Sacramento. It's also, as you say, it's the city council members. It's the county boards of supervisors. It's the neighborhood activists that also have to say, you know what? Time for change. And it's time for us to have audacious goals. This state doesn't even have a housing goal. There's no specific strategy.
So your audacious goal of 500,000 units or so per year for the next seven or so years?
Well, yeah, we can extend it out. It is profoundly audacious, correct.
And that we're going to hold you to that number? Is that
the
number we should hold you to?
No, because I don't, with respect, that's sort of the usual politicking. Here's my point being, be audacious. Because in the process of being audacious, you'll discover what you're capable of being. So hold me account to being audacious and in the process doing more than we've ever done. The worst thing you should argue for is someone who says, you know what, I'm going to increase by 5% our housing production. And then everyone says, boy, you exceeded it by 10%. But you know what? This place is even worse off than it was a few years ago.
And that's a very good point. And by that point, may I hold you accountable for the 12,000 units that you talked about in San Francisco. Was that not audacious enough, given the result is now worse than it when it was when you
proposed it? Well, every city, as I said, I don't. You can show me a city, and I could show you a challenge in one specific area above any other: homelessness and housing affordability. It is a broad issue across the state.
But should you have done more when you were mayor of San Francisco to prevent what we see now?
I should have done thousands of things more. Absolutely. In a world of hindsight, everybody should be accountable for all the things they missed and didn't do. But we certainly did some things that I'll put up against any big city in the state.
Okay. Are you or are you not in favor of and are going to introduce the idea of single-payer health
care? I support single-payer, been consistent, but I'm not ideological about how to achieve it. SB 562, if you're referring to that, was amended 17 times by the authors before it was killed in committee. It's a work in progress. It's a complicated issue, and it requires leadership, requires resolve. I was a county mayor, not a city mayor. I have a lot of history on health care. As I said, we did it. Regardless of pre-existing conditions, ability to pay, regardless of your immigration status, we fully implemented, actually enjoying its 10th anniversary this year, our universal health care plan. It wasn't easy.
No but that's one knew not single payer. It's universal, which is a difference.
Of course there's a difference, but the fact is it was novel. It was unique. No one thought it could be done. It's really a robust public option. Has a lot of the core tenets because there is a single payer financing component to it. It's health care, not health insurance. I understand its limitations, but at the same time, it was bold. We got folks together. My resolve is to do that as governor for one reason alone. It's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do, but it's also the economically most important thing the state can do because the budget is being devoured by healthcare costs. And if people just believe you can, pony up for the status quo, I can assure you the issues of tuition increases, the issues of stress and burden that's going to be placed on county budgets as a consequence of healthcare spend is going to devour all other investments unless we tame it.
Okay, so you are going to, that's going to be one of your top priorities.
Absolutely.
Is to take on single payer health insurance and try to get that through?
I am committed to the goal and I'm committed to bringing all the parties together. Not even in my first 100 days, this has to be a priority during a transition if we're actually going to achieve something big.
What does that mean for people who pay taxes here in California? The estimate was that this would cost $400 billion. That's what, twice the amount of the budget the governor just unveiled.
Yeah, those are sort of so, profound misleading. I'll say this to the
but
the
it would require a tax increase, would it?
On the one side of the ledger, and then complete elimination of a cost structure on the other side, which arguably is it's just interesting.
Meaning you would pay more in you're paying more in health insurance premiums, you're saying, than you would pay in a tax.
Well, you eliminate
increase.
Copays, you eliminate deductibles, you eliminate any of the cost burdens.
So it would be net less per.
Of course, for this reason, single payer exists in countries all around the world. The one thing that's universally factual about single payer is there's not a country in the world that on a per capita basis spends more than the United States, which is a multi-payer system. So you can say anything you want about single payer. The one thing you can't say, with any evidence to back it up at least, is that it costs more money. So the fact of cost is a transitional question, is how do you go from one system to a new system, and how do you mine that gap?
Okay. But, I mean, you do have to be honest with the taxpayers that there could be a tax increase. Might be offset with the fewer health insurance premiums and the deductibles and all that you're talking about, but there would be a tax increase in one of the highest tax states of the union.
Well, the point is, I want to bring down the cost of health care, and the only evidence in the world suggests that a single-payer financing system is a way of achieving that. There's zero evidence to argue in favor of the status quo in a multi-payer system that is inefficient, wasteful, and costly. And one thing I know, there's certainly ample evidence that you ain't seen nothing yet as it relates to the taxes that will have to be increased to pay for the status quo. Mm-hmm. And that's just interesting. That's never offered up as a point of conversation.
I just want to ask a sort of a general question about you and how people might perceive you. A Sacramento Bee columnist has called you the living embodiment of privilege. As someone who has the backing of
I read that. It was one
Gordon
of the most
Getty.
Insulting articles I've ever read. But let me tell you a little bit about my background. I come from a single mom who was a teenager when she had me. Single, divorced. A couple years later, raised two kids on her own, came from nothing. My mother passed 16 years ago, breast cancer, left nothing except grit, hard work, and an example. I worked my way up. I had severe dyslexia growing up. I went from 4 to 7 schools in 10 years and bounced around and worked hard. Janitor, paper route, Jeff Hicks Construction, did the kind of things that all of us do with a family that is trying to make ends meet. So there's a lot of mythology out there. To the extent that I started a business, 13 investors, everyone put up a big investment with $7,500. It was a lot of money. I built that business, opened a second business, and have built a series of other businesses. And the fact is, if those businesses weren't successful, if we didn't make them work, they wouldn't have grown. And I'm very proud of that business background. I think I'm the only candidate, certainly on the Democratic side, with a small business background, created 800 plus jobs. And I don't know if that's privilege, but I've been privileged by my mom's example, by the extraordinary example of my father, who was a big environmentalist and someone who cared deeply about public policy, and probably is the reason I'm sitting here in front of you today.
Oh, no, well-respected judge.
Yeah.
But weren't you also considered by Gordon Getty basically a surrogate son of
his? It's news
his?
To me. Last name's Newsom, not Getty. Plenty of ample evidence of that.
But I think, he's a big supporter of you and
yeah, but,
took an interest in you as a,
yeah,
as a
no,
young boy.
Yeah, I've got 120, I don't know how many investors there are in all the businesses. We're really proud of that. And he was one of those first 13 early investors and I think owned 4% of the business. So you can make, you know, you can connect whatever dot you want. And now I've got some other businesses of which he's my principal investor as the businesses have grown. And I'm very proud. He's an extraordinary person that I've had the privilege of growing up with. But my last name's Newsom.
Okay. Do your kids go to public school?
Yes.
And will they go to public school?
I hope so.
Sacramento,
I'm going to do what's in
their
best interest. And I love our public school. I love our public school teachers. I've got 4 kids. The oldest just turned 8. Looks like she's got the same learning disability I do. And that's a challenge. So I'm going to make sure I do what I can to make sure she gets the kind of support that everybody deserves.
Your wife is very active in women's rights issues, correct?
She's been extraordinary. She's done 4 films, 2 she's produced, 2 she's directed and written, one on the issue of women and girls called Misrepresentation, about the misrepresentation, not just the underrepresentation of women, one on hypermasculinity called The Mask You Live In.
Right. And so misrepresentation is about women not being in positions of power, and that if you don't see women in positions of power as a girl, you can't imagine yourself in a position of
power.
Yeah,
I mean, I've quibbled with her a little bit, but she says you can't be what you can't see. But I think that could also be limiting, because if you don't see something, it doesn't necessarily mean you can't be it. But she makes that. She posits that. It's interesting. There's a great clip in her film with Nancy Pelosi. Nancy said, you know, the number one question I got when I was running for Congress was, who's going to take care of the kids? It was the number one question, Nancy said. Everywhere I got, every town hall, who's taking care of the kids? She joked that 3 out of 4 of them were in college. And the point is this. I've been doing this now for a couple years, finished those 30-plus town halls. I've done 10 debates. Not one person has ever asked me, who's going to take care of the kids? And yet I have a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old,
well,
an 8-year-old.
We'll ask you, who's going to take care of the kids?
And we're all doing our best. But it shows the bias. It shows, again, that's the misrepresentation.
No, but really, who's going to take care
we're
of the
doing,
kids?
We're doing. I mean, Jen's working her tail off. I'm working hard on it. I'm going to see them tonight. I've been on the road 6 days.
But
one
I guess
of the sacrifices
the question
of this office.
I was leading up to is why, you know, given what your wife is talking about in misrepresentation, why is it not time for a woman to be governor?
Well, I think, you know, when I was elected, I appointed the first female police chief, first female fire chief, first female director of Office of Emergency Service, first female director of the Public Utilities Commission, and the Port Commission. I say that to make this point, all dominated historically by men. And I did that because it was the right thing to do. I replaced myself on the County Board of Supervisors with Michaela Alliopier, who happened to be a woman. Also, she happened to be in a wheelchair and disabled. So I think you can be a champion for women. I was a champion for LGBT community. I'm not a member of that community. When we started sanctioning same-sex marriage, you can represent diverse communities regardless of your fate.
When do you think there should be a woman as governor?
Oh, any opportunity, any chance. I think it's fabulous. And
just not this time.
No, I mean, obviously, look, I don't want to be flippant about it, but I'm running, and I think we offer something very unique and different, particularly with Jen's work, that we can bring into this office that I think will really elevate the issues of women and girls. And
would she have a role in your administration?
Oh my gosh, she has a role in my life. I'm here. I'm a product of everything she advocates. It's a big part of our lives, the work she does and the work I do, and so absolutely unequivocally.
And your family would be living in Sacramento?
I'll be honest with you. I cannot think past.
Because they don't now, right?
I can't think past the next 20 days, and I couldn't even think past November in that respect.
All right. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how the fight between CBS and Viacom could radically change both companies. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A legal fight between a media heiress and a network CEO. Sounds like the premise for a CBS courtroom drama, but it's actually a real-life CBS legal drama. Sherry Redstone of the Redstone family controls both CBS and Viacom, and she wants to merge those two companies. But CBS CEO Les Moonves is not having it. He's trying to limit Redstone's power while she tries to oust him from his own network. Thankfully, our very own Kim Masters is here to help us sort through this mess. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So what happened this week?
Yes, it is a mess.
In court. I mean, there
okay,
was...
Okay, well, we have not been conclusively told, just to be clear, that Sherry Redstone wants to get rid of Les Moonves, but Les Moonves wants to get rid of Sherry Redstone. She does control CBS and Viacom voting shares, so she has outsized influence. And what happened after this on-again, off-again merger talk, and Sherry feels that she has to bulk these companies up and... is very challenged with BET and Comedy Central and Nickelodeon cable channels that are losing their audience in a cord-cutting era. She feels like she has to merge CBS and Viacom. And it's not that Les Moonves was totally opposed to that, but he certainly was opposed to that if he smelled her interfering with him, because he's had a lot of autonomy. So he did something incredibly audacious, which was CBS, he would say his board did this, a special committee, went to court and tried to work out a situation where they could vote basically to completely dilute Sherry Redstone's interest, even though she has had this position for a long time and her father before her, and he still has an interest. He went to court to say, we're going to have this vote, we're going to basically get rid of her, and we need a restraining order because she's going to try and stop us, and that would be bad, so please issue an order making sure that she cannot stop us from getting rid of her. And that, they took a swing. It was like, even the judge was like, I'm sorry, what is this? And the judge would not give them that restraining order. Now, nonetheless, CBS is voting symbolically because she's already changed the rules, so they can't get rid of her unless they have pretty much everybody on the board, and Sherry sits on the board. So CBS will still have the majority of its board vote to say, we want to dilute Sherry Redstone's interest here, just to show that most of its board wants this. And then I don't know what will happen, because the judge did warn Sherry Redstone, you know, I'm not going to give you this, give them this order to keep you from getting involved here, but you are a shareholder, you are a controlling shareholder of CBS. You have a duty to CBS. And if you do anything that hurts CBS, you could get in trouble with the law. So he's saying, it's tough to know what she then can do. Mm. It's like I would say this, Madeline, it's like she has two children. CBS is healthy, Viacom not so much. And she is not in a position to say, I'm going to hurt CBS to make Viacom better, because she owes the shareholders of CBS just as she owes the shareholders of Viacom.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. And that's Les Moonves' big argument, is that she would damage CBS irrevocably if she forced this merger.
Well, if she forces, you know, he feels, yes, that ultimately she will want to get rid of him, especially now for some reason, because he tried to get rid of her. And yes, he feels that her terms for this merger are toxic. They basically, last weekend, the CBS decided, you know what, on any terms, this merger is just a bad idea for us and we don't want it. And CBS had an approach from Verizon. Their argument is reportedly from Verizon, I should say. That's not official, but that's what everybody thinks. And they're basically like, look, we're desirable, but Sherry would not let us sell ourselves to Verizon. If scale is so important, how come we couldn't sell ourselves and become big by making a deal with Verizon? Because she's favoring her other, she wouldn't leave the other sick child behind and let us go ahead.
Is there any way that both of them could get what they wanted? Is there any way that she could figure out how to shore up Viacom and keep CBS independent?
At this point, she would... you know, she would have to capitulate to him if she wants to keep him on the job. And the problem from her end is that Wall Street enthusiastically backs Les Moonves for the most part, almost unanimously. And, you know, they had the upfront presentations this past week, and he got a standing ovation when he walked out on the stage because the advertisers are like, Les has kept this broadcast network strong in face of tremendous headwinds. We like him. So the message being sent to her is not, she can't sort of paint Les Moonves with a brush that, look, you know, he's getting old, he's 68. After all, how long can he stay here? He needs to do more planning. Whatever argument she wants to gin up, I think she's going to have a tough time selling to Wall Street or advertisers.
But he acknowledged, I think, right, this week at the upfront, said this could be his last upfront.
Well, yeah, I'm told almost emotional because it very well could be. I mean, at the end of the day, owners tend to win these fights, you know, but in this case, if there's anyone who could step out in front of an owner and rattle both the owner and, you know, Hollywood and Wall Street, all of those things at the same time, it is Les Moonves, because he is one of the really last of the old school, strong creative executives running a media company.
Well, meanwhile, Sherry Redstone, she's relatively new to this position, right? And her dad, Sumner, who will turn 95 next week, is still in the background, way in the background. Does he have any say or any control or any ability?
She would like people to believe that he is supporting her in this effort. That he has in the past not exactly been the unconditional loving father saying, you can do it, sweetie, by any means. He's a tough guy, and he was tough on her and publicly, and did not express unconditional belief that she could run this company. She does want people to believe that he cannot speak. He is very frail. He literally cannot speak, but she wants people to think that he is behind her. And, you know, there are those who say he isn't capable of knowing what's going on at this point. That if this litigation somehow drags out, that could become a sensitive point, trying to, you know, figure out, can Sumner Redstone even have an opinion right now?
Well, anyway, Viacom and CBS will not emerge unscathed, no matter what happens, right?
I just don't see how not, you know. As I said, maybe she's going to just stand down for a little while, but I know she feels, you know, we're seeing Disney buy Fox, AT&T, with any luck, in the court, will buy Time Warner. These people want to fight against Amazon and Netflix, these giant new companies with their new technologies. She is going to be very nervous sitting there and waiting for Viacom's situation to get worse and worse. You know, it's a big job to turn that thing around. She had to fight for control of Viacom. She won, but she was up against a weak CEO in Philippe Domon. This is a different matter because Les is not weak.
All right, Kim, thank you so much.
You're my pleasure.
Okay, stay tuned, as they say. Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Okay, Warren Olney is here now. He's been listening in, and you like what you heard?
I like very much what I heard. I think it's absolutely fascinating, and of course, there's nobody better to talk about
than
you two guys. We're going to be talking on our podcast this week with an Israeli columnist who invokes the tale of two cities, the best of times, the worst of times, so talking about one country, Israel, with on the one hand the American embassy opening up, while at the same time, 55 miles away, the Israeli army is slaughtering Palestinians. We'll talk with him. We'll talk with Martin Indyk, a former ambassador ambassador to Israel and to the peace process, mm-hmm. who says that it is ridiculous for President Trump to say that this is in any way going to help the peace process to move the embassy and open it under these circumstances without making room for the Palestinians. We'll also talk about the potential impact on voters in the United States, Jewish voters in particular, Democrats in particular. What are the consequences if support for Israel becomes a partisan issue in the United States?
All right. Thank you. That sounds great. Really on point, on topic. To the point.
To the point.
A podcast. Get it where you get your podcasts at kcrw.com.
Living up to the name.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Warren Olney. Coming up on this program, how robots are becoming us.
When the network has a little trouble, the device turns red and it says, sorry, I can't answer that right now. And my daughters, they cover their ears and they think that Alexa's mad, that she doesn't want to answer.
The new voice assistant technology is erasing the line between human and machine. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The line between human and machine is more blurred than ever. Just listen to this.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
What time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
Okay, you can probably guess which one was the robot, but it's not easy. Google had demoed its new AI technology. It's called Duplex at the company's annual developer conference earlier this month. And after they played that bit, it is a call between a Google assistant, the Duplex, and a person taking a hair appointment. The crowd laughed and cheered. But some people are warning about the perils of AI. Researchers say they can send hidden commands to Alexa now, to Siri and Google Assistant, hidden commands that human ears cannot detect. So in the wrong hands, that technology could be used to secretly dial phone numbers. It could be used to unlock doors or maybe wire money. Well, despite the potential privacy issues, some people are really all in on voice assistants, like Alan Rodriguez, who has 3 Alexas and 1 Google Assistant in his Pasadena home.
Alexa, what's the best radio station in LA?
There's nothing better than KCRW.
Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Did you make Alexa say that?
I did not make Alexa say that. It was actually a pleasant surprise when we tested it out this morning at our office.
How did she know? I'm just going to call her a her.
Yeah, I reference her as a her as well. So, I suspect maybe because I'm always listening to KCRW.
Oh, okay.
So maybe she's accustomed to me, listening to that.
Or she's telling you what you want to hear?
She's pretty good about that.
She doesn't really disagree with you. She sounds like an ideal mate.
Well, to some degree, yes.
Okay, so you have 3 Alexas, though, right? And a Google Assistant?
I do.
Why so many?
What's kind of cool about the Alexa device is you can use them as intercoms. And so it's like a modern throwback to the 1960s wired house, right? So what's great is if you have one in the living room and you want to call your kids over to dinner and they're in the room, then you could just drop in and say, hey, girls, dinner time. Come on over. So we have one in every room in the house just to kind of add an additional layer of convenience, turning lights on, turning lights off, shutting down the TV, et cetera.
Oh, okay. Do you have them in your daughter's rooms?
I do.
And what do they use them for? How old are your daughters, by the way?
So I have 2 daughters. They're 4 years old. And they use Alexa mostly for entertainment. So primarily playing music. But there's a couple of other things they like doing with Alexa. For instance, they might ask Alexa, what does a whale sound like? And Alexa will respond with some whale sounds.
How do they see Alexa? Do they see Alexa as a creature? Do they understand that this is just a machine?
It's kind of creepy. I think on some level they understand that she's a machine, but then because of their interaction and the voice activation part of the experience, I think they also view her as kind of almost sentient or an actual personality. So, for instance, this morning, the network was having a little trouble. And when the network has a little trouble, the device turns red and it says, sorry, I can't answer that right now. And my daughters, they cover their ears and they think that Alexa's mad, that she doesn't want to answer the question.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's kind of horrible, but it's also kind of interesting how they clearly know it's a machine. They can unplug it, right? Uh-huh. But they see something like that and they're just like, oh, Alexa's mad. Well, you know, I have a hell of a time trying to explain to them that she's not.
Well, do you worry about that in terms of their development? Like they might be forming an attachment to this machine?
Kind of. I wouldn't say it's top of mind. I think these machines are designed to do that, to, you know, create an attachment. You know, I think there's studies have shown that, you know, female voices are more trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And so it's no surprise that a lot of these devices have female voices for that specific purpose. And I think for a company to increase utilization of the device, they kind of create these algorithms that form personality. Do I worry about it? Yes and no. I mean, I think the future's headed that way anyway. And it's one of those things where you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So
you could have just one toothpaste, not four.
Right. That's true. But I think because they're going to grow up familiar with these technologies, whether I introduce them to it or not, I'd rather kind of take a more proactive role and then kind of teach them like it is just a device. And ultimately, it is just an algorithm.
Are you worried at all about privacy?
No, not really. You know, I work in technology and the idea that somebody can be online and maintain privacy is really just kind of a myth. I mean, any journalist with decent researching skills can find out a ton of information within 20 minutes, you know, from accessing certain databases and whatnot. So I'm not too worried about that.
But there have been cases of Alexas listening in when people didn't think they were.
Yeah, I'm aware of those. And I think in my case, you know, I'm also aware of that, right? So you can mute the device if you wanted to have a particular conversation that you thought was sensitive. But, you know, again, having a background in technology, hacking and dropping in is just a part of the business. And I think if you're really concerned about like having those kind of private conversations, then you need to find a park or someplace far away from like any electronic device.
If such a place exists anymore.
Yeah, right.
So you have a Google Assistant as well as your three Alexas.
Yes.
Why do you have this other one and what's the difference?
We got it mostly for comparison. We want to see, you know, how they perform alongside of each other. One of the difficulties is with this emerging technology is that it has to learn your voice. You know, sometimes accuracy is a problem. I'll give you an example. So like with my daughters, they use Alexa for entertainment and listening to music. And they asked Alexa to play, what they intended was for Alexa to play the Coco theme soundtrack on Spotify. And instead, the song Coco, I think by OT Genesis, came on. And I don't know if you have heard the song, but the lyrics are really about cocaine. And so now my daughters have been singing this song, you know, I have baking soda, and it drives me crazy. It's an unintended, you know, consequence of like poor listening skills on Alexa. I mean, they're 4 years old, so, you know, nobody's at fault all around, but we got the Google Assistant to see if it would improve like voice recognition, but they seem to be on par.
So why aren't they answering your phone for you?
Oh, because my staff should be doing that.
So humans are still useful in some way.
Yeah. In a lot of ways.
For now.
Yeah.
All right, Alan, thank you very much.
All right, I appreciate your time.
That was Alan Rodriguez. He has three Alexas, one Google Assistant, and twin daughters, human daughters. Coming up, Google wants even more control over our lives. We'll find out what the grand plan is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're talking about the increasing sophistication of voice assistant technology and whether we should embrace or fear the robots. Before the break, we heard from a dad who definitely embraces them. Now for some perspective on where this technology might lead us, we have Will Arimus. He's Slate's senior technology writer, and he's been writing about AI. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, we talked a little bit about earlier in the show, we talked a little bit about this new AI technology Google has called Duplex, and Google demoed it earlier this month. And I just want to play a little bit more so listeners can refresh their memory about how uncanny this voice assistant really is.
See, how may I help you?
Hi, I'd like to reserve a table for Wednesday the 7th.
For 7 people?
It's for 4 people.
Okay. So there you have the Duplex is the male voice, which sounds exactly like a human, Will. Did that freak you out when you saw that?
It amazed me. I mean, this was like one of those classic tech demos where the audience's collective jaw drops all at once. But there are questions that have been raised since then about how authentic was this. There was actually a good post in Axios Today by Dan Primack that said, nobody actually answers the phone the way the people answered the phone in those demos. They tell you the name of the hair salon or the restaurant first, and then they say, can I help you or how can I help you? So there are some questions as to how many calls Google had to make before it got those specific results. That said, it did seem magical.
Right, because in that extended bit, when you extend it and they played it, the Google assistant is calling a restaurant and the woman who answers the phone has a really thick accent and there's some misunderstanding as to what they want, like whether it's 4 people or 7 people, whether it's at 6 p.m. or later. And the Google assistant sort of deftly works around her confusion and you're left thinking, wow. Not only does it sound like a real human, it understands other humans and can react accordingly.
Exactly. And so between that ability to navigate misunderstandings and then the verbal tics that Google put in there, the and the to make it sound more human, you have a level of voice interaction that we've just never seen before. But that's also why it's raising some questions. I mean, anybody who has an Alexa or a Google Assistant at home knows that it is not that perfect at navigating misunderstandings. So we'll see where the technology actually stands once this becomes more of a reality instead of just a demo on stage.
Okay, so once it becomes a reality, we can't avoid it?
I think we can't avoid it in the sense that it's been a long time dream of people who design computer interfaces to make those interfaces as natural as possible. When you think about early computers, you had the command line and you had to learn to speak basically a different language to get the computer to work. You had to speak computer language. Well, over time, with the graphical user interface, Windows and Macs and then touch screens, those interfaces have gotten more natural and more seamless. The voice interface is really it's close to a culmination of the tech world's dream where now the computer speaks your language instead of you having to learn its language.
What is the goal for Google here? Why does it want to get into this technology instead of just be what it is now, which is a search engine and a maps company?
Well, the goal for a company like Google is they want you to use their services as much as possible, as frequently as possible. And so the more seamless they can make it for you to use their services, the more presumably you'll use them. And I think we've seen that in action with Alexa and Google Home. I mean, people ask questions of Google Home while they're doing the dishes or while they're having a conversation with their family. And those are things that you wouldn't necessarily get up and run to a computer to do a search. But if you can just say, hey, Google, how tall is the Empire State Building? And have it answer, then you're using Google in a new instance where you wouldn't have used it before. Oh my gosh, and I should say that my Google Home just responded to me while I was answering that question.
That is really funny, but also illustrative of how it's trying to insinuate itself into your every moment. I mean,
when you think that
it's not doing it, it's listening to you.
Yeah, and it actually will break into your conversation unexpectedly, which is another thing that, you know, sort of traditional computing devices typically don't do.
Why does Google Assistant not have a name?
That's a really good question. I mean, Google Assistant is the name, but they've avoided giving it a humanizing name. I don't know why that is, but I kind of appreciate it because one of the dangers here is that if we think of these devices as humans, if we think of them as a friend or a member of the family, then we may start to trust them more than is really warranted by the technology. I mean, these are machines that are powered by software written by huge multinational corporations whose interests may not always coincide with our own. You don't have to think that Google or Amazon is evil to recognize that the motivations built into Alexa or the Google Assistant may not always have your best interests at heart.
Well, how do you envision it? I mean, do you see it as benign or malign, potentially? We heard from Alan earlier. He thinks, well, you know, just give into it and it's fine and it's great for convenience and my kids love it. But then, you know, there is the Hal scenario. There is the Black Mirror scenario. Where do you fall on that?
I'm somewhere in between. I use them partly because my job is to understand them. I try to remind myself on a regular basis that this is not a friend. That we do have to be cautious. And I try to mute it when I'm having a sensitive conversation. But it's hard to remember to do because the companies design these products to be as convenient as possible, and they try to make you forget that what you're really dealing with here is software that's designed to ultimately make money for Amazon or for Google.
Well, then that raises the next question. So far, we see them as passive, doing what we want, but will there be a time when they actually influence us to do things they want?
Yeah, absolutely.
And by they, I don't know who they is, but...
No, I mean, I think they're already doing that. I mean, the Google Assistant in particular, not just in its voice form in the Google Home, but in its software form on an Android device, it already proactively makes recommendations. It says, "Hey, you know, your favorite band is coming to town. Do you want to buy tickets?" And then when it does that, when it reaches out and tries to make things really seamless for you, that means that Google gets to choose the vendor. I mean, maybe it has partnered with some company that sells tickets. And this is a hypothetical, by the way, but it does things like this.
Do you like your Google Assistant?
I guess it depends how you mean the word like. I like Google, but not in that way. I enjoy it. I mean, I find a lot of parents of young children, which I am, find it incredibly convenient because so often your hands are not free and you just want to be able to get some quick information or, you know, you want to be able to have your kid be able to interact with it maybe before they're ready to operate a laptop. My 3-year-old can say, "Hey, Google, play Puff the Magic Dragon." So I like it, but I'm wary of it.
Okay. Willa Remus, Slate senior technology writer. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
You know, Christian Bordahl, I can see the day when that Google Assistant can host a radio show.
Uh-oh.
I know. Seriously.
And then what happens? Then Madeline Brand is put out to pasture?
I guess then I will be the assistant to the Google Assistant.
Right. Well, Clement VIII says just the fact that I can use it to turn off the TV makes it worth its weight in gold.
Okay.
Chelsea
Wait,
Pope's...
Don't they have a remote for that?
Yeah, but then you have to find the remote and press the button. And...
It's too much effort.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chelsea Pope says, "Alexa wakes me up to KCRW every day and I love it. She laughed one time in the middle of the night, though, and that all of a sudden that woke me up."
I wonder what the joke was.
Makes me laugh. And Anthony Williams, however, says, "I don't have one. They're creeping me out more and more. I recently turned Siri off on my phone, too. I always ended up going to Google after asking it for help anyway." So far, 20% of people I asked said they're great, they love them, they have them. 13% said yes, but I don't use it that much. 10% said they're probably going to get one, they don't have one yet. 57% said no way, never, I ain't going there.
They say that now.
Exactly. But then, you know, sooner or later.
They're powerless to resist.
Alexa.
I want to know what people would name the Google Assistant if they could. They should have a crowdfunding naming.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we're out of time, so.
Okay. Dang, I was going to come up with some names.
All right, well, think on it.
Okay.
Christian Bordahl, that's a good name. Or Resident Norwegian. How about that? I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.